Where are you from? Do you have questions about your ancestry? Are you looking to reconnect to your ethnic identity or even discover your long-lost relatives? Today's guest will teach you how to connect to your roots and build upon your family story while still going your own way. Welcome to Unleash Your Inner Creative with Lauren LaGrasso. I'm Lauren LaGrasso. I'm an award-winning podcast host and producer, singer-songwriter, and multi-passionate creative. And this show is meant to give you tools to love, trust, and know yourself enough to claim your right to creativity and pursue whatever it is that's on your heart. Today's guest is Lee Esposito. She's an author, content creator, leader in the Italian-American community, former litigator, and double Ivy League graduate. Thank you very much. She is best known for her Instagram following of nearly 30,000 people. And on her page, she talks all about Italian and Sicilian culture. And she's also known for her upcoming book, The Godmother, which you have to check out. It's available for pre-order now. Now, something that Lee and I both have in common is that we're incredibly passionate about being Italian-American. We love tracing the lines of our lineage to make sense of who we are and who we might become. Lee has an incredible story of how she went from being a lawyer to becoming a stay-at-home mom to, during the course of the pandemic, having her relationship with her now ex-husband dissolve and finding a way to support herself and her family by pursuing her dream of becoming a content creator and author. There's so much to learn from this incredible woman. You will learn how to get over fear and go toward your dream, even if you don't have experience in the area you want to go toward. How to reconnect with your ethnic identity, let your ancestors guide you, the connection between spirituality and creativity, how to listen to your own soul, and so much more. Now here she is, the incredible Lee Esposito. Lee, welcome to the show. You are literally my dream guest. You're everything I dream of. We're going to talk about spirituality, being Sicilian, being strong women, and reclaiming our identity. I mean, literally everything I ever want to talk about in life is your expertise. So thank you for being here.
I'm so happy to be here.
Honestly, honored to have you and like so thrilled that you exist in the world and to see how quickly you're growing and what a hunger there is for rediscovering our ethnic identity and the truth of our ethnic identity.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I want to tell a little bit of your story, but one of the reasons why I'm so excited to have you on is because, number one, this past summer, I met my long-lost family in Sicily, and I had never been there before. I didn't realize that my grandfather left a brother behind. I was always told that he came over to America because his brother, which I thought was his one and only brother, died at sea. But what I didn't know is he had a younger brother that stayed behind with his mom and that we have cousins there. Like my dad's first cousins are still there. So I showed up on their doorstep and said, "Hello, my name is Lauren LaGrasso. I think I'm your cousin," and was completely embraced by them. So I've really been rediscovering this. Why did we lose so much of our culture? What happened? How did we lose touch with them? There's so much to go through. And your page has been starting to heal that piece of me to see that there's other people going through the same thing, that I'm not alone in this journey. The other thing is our culture has such strong women and yet they're still stifled. And that never really made sense to me. It's like the women are so strong, but yet there feels like there's limitations on what it means to be an Italian woman. And through discovering your page, I've realized we come from a society where women were leaders and then the Catholic Church came in and that kind of flipped things, it seems like, from what you say. So anyway, just to give you a little precursor of my love for you, it's coming from that place.
Wow, I could relate to so much of what you're saying. I had the same experience last summer. I went back and found my long lost relatives in Sicily. You know, I loved White Lotus, but that scene where they go to the house just, you know, it really miffed me because, first of all, it perpetuates the stereotype of Sicilians as kind of like stolid, agrarian, nonverbal peasants, which those characters were. And they are fictional characters, but it was the only glimpse we had of Sicilians reconnecting with their family. And if there's something I can convey to the listeners right now, it's go meet your family. They're not going to chase you off with a pitchfork. That's ridiculous.
It couldn't have been more different from my experience. I mean, I literally was just texting my family on WhatsApp before I got in here. I'm like, I'm so excited. I'm interviewing a Sicilian American woman today. And they sent me like, kisses. We're so excited for you. You are adorable. They could not have been more excited to reconnect. In fact, to the point where the minute we got into the apartment, they had a folder that said American Photo, F-O-T-O on it.
and they pulled it out. And it wasn't like they had to dig through to find these. They were sitting on their like kitchen counter. They had been waiting for us.
Wow.
And my one cousin wrote in the, you know, because unfortunately my grandpa didn't pass down the language. So I'm learning it, but I don't speak it fluently and certainly didn't at that time. But he wrote into Google Translate as we were trying to speak to each other, this moment has been awaited for 70 years. So maybe there are some people who would be annoyed, but I didn't meet any of them.
When I was in Sicily last May, I went twice last year. I went with Mary Beth Bonfilio, who's an amazing resource for our community for reconnecting with Sicilian roots. Her company is called Radici Siciliane, and she takes small groups to Sicily to connect with ancestral practices. She took us to this little museum in a town called Petralia Sotana that's just a man's house where he collected all of these artifacts from the times when our ancestors would have left. And he had this whole room of like the postcards that the ones that emigrated from Italy had sent home and like the pictures of the weddings they didn't get to attend. And I never thought about the people left behind.
Yeah.
There's also a great exhibit about this at the Italian American Museum of Los Angeles run by Mariana Gatto. She has also found these, you know, artifacts of someone's sister knitting her brother a wallet and sent to him because many of them just never saw their family again.
Yeah. My grandpa left when he was 15. And by the time he had earned enough money to go back, his mom passed away. So he did go back and see his brother. But for some reason, that story, like by the time I was born, never made its way to me. Like I knew he went back, but I didn't know he had a brother. And I think my dad was almost like scared to reconnect with his cousins there. I don't know what it was. Maybe it was just like a heartbreak or a feeling of like, how will we talk? I don't know the language. But his cousin had reached out to him, Pino, who I ended up showing up at his doorstep. Pino had reached out to him 12 years ago in 2009. So it was now more than 12 years ago. But he sent a letter to my dad and my dad never replied to it. He just kept it. He kept it in a file. And when I decided I want to go back, like I want to go see where my grandpa is from and go to Marsala, he gave me the letter and was like, here, go to this address. And so I showed up at the doorstep unannounced because we didn't have a number. All we had was that address. I mean, somehow they were still living there. Yeah, I mean, that story really brings tears to my eyes because they had been waiting for us, you know?
Mm-hmm. There's an openness to our people in some senses, but there's also a lot of secretiveness,
mm-hmm.
especially as Sicilians. There is omerta. And it's, you know, of course, that has to do with you keep your mouth shut with regard to the mafia. But yeah. There is a sense of like, let's not tell what we don't need to tell. Let's just move on from that. There are many stories like that that I only learned from other relatives than my immediate ancestors. Like I was so close with my grandparents and I never learned my grandfather's grandparents' names until I started talking to his cousin who's talkative. Because I think that there was so much pain that the immediate emigrants from Italy, I think they just compartmentalized. It's like, that's it, but you gotta keep going forward.
They did what they had to do to survive. I mean, honestly, it was back in May, June 2020, when the Black Lives Matter movement happened and people started talking about white supremacy, that was the first time I realized what our people did to attain whiteness. And we use the word assimilate, which is much nicer, but it really was white supremacy. The way that affected Italian culture was we gave up parts of our culture. We cut off parts of ourselves. We changed our names. We changed our first names. We changed our last names. That was how whiteness and trying to achieve whiteness, which was a survival tactic at that time, robbed us of so much of our ethnic identity. And so ever since then, I've been trying to retrace the steps of what happened and figure out how do we get that back? What did we actually lose? How can I get it back in an authentic way? What traditions of my own do I want to start that maybe I never had access to? But yeah, it's been a wild road to realize that.
We had a lot of barriers, all of us immigrants from the early 20th century back, mm-hmm. and the people who were hauled here against their will, to the people who were fooled here through forms of quasi-indentured servitude, which includes Chinese Americans, which includes early Italian immigrants. When we got here, it was like you had to survive. Mm-hmm. And sitting in your enclave and speaking your language, You had no power. You had no way of earning money if you just kept doing that. It's not like now where we have communities like K-Town in Los Angeles, you know, like places where you can go and it's, you can speak your native language and your children can retain their native language. You know, in this Italian American Museum of Los Angeles, another exhibit was Negroes and Italians need not apply.
Yeah.
That was a very common grouping. We really had, especially in the South, in New Orleans and stuff. And you're right that it's a huge loss. And especially because I think with names changing, you know, people marrying their, my son doesn't have an Italian name at all. It's also hard to find each other.
Yeah.
I can find you. You can find me. We have vowels at the end of our last names, you know, like, but how do we find like Dr. Jill Biden and one of my close friends, Dr. Shannon Curry, half Sicilian, prominent, well-known psychologist? That's another thing, is we have to step forward and seek this community because it won't find a lot of us.
Yeah, it's so true. I love that post that you did about Italian-American famous women who we wouldn't realize are Italian. And yeah, it was powerful to see because there are a lot of people, even Dean Martin had to change his name from Dino, and I don't remember what his last name was, but it wasn't Martin, I don't
think. No, it was long. It wasn't even Martino. I think it was like a long last name.
Yeah.
Tony Bennett.
Yeah, and they made Dean Martin get a nose job too because his nose looked too Italian. Even my grandpa, I was thinking about it, you know, his name was Lorenzo, but everybody called him Larry because Lorenzo was too Italian. My grandfather's name, my other grandfather, the one that was born in Marsala, his name was Matteo. But everybody called him Michael because Matteo was too Italian. So it's wild. I just didn't realize any of that until literally the last 3 years. But retracing the steps has been healing and heartbreaking.
I mean, absolutely. My grandmother had a similar experience to your family members too. Her name was actually changed by her teacher, which I've come to understand is not uncommon. Wow. Among Italian American stories, her teacher felt that the spelling of her name, Dolores, D-O-L-O-R-E-S, was too Italian. So she changed it to D-E-L-O-R-E-S. That type of thing, we have so far to go in this country, but we are starting to do some really good things with that's not okay. And everybody's not on board with that yet, but it's a growing voice that's saying that's not okay. If this is your name, this is your name. We can have the respect to learn how to pronounce it instead of changing it to something we're more comfortable with.
Yeah. And I think the fact of the matter is people start to understand when it gets personal, right? So hopefully like the most evolved of us can engage with empathy and perspective taking and can understand other people's point of view and then adhere to what they're saying and believe them. But I think it's really important for whatever your ethnic identity is to realize how these things are affecting you too. Like, what has the loss been for you personally? What have you glossed over because you were trying to fit in? And retracing that. And I just think you're doing such a beautiful job and you're taking all your lawyering skills and all your writing skills and your communication skills and just bringing them together in a way that is so intelligent and yet so relatable on your page. And I'm so grateful for you.
Thank you so much. I mean, everybody's come along with me on my journey of reconnecting with my culture. Because up until my family moved to California when I was 12, before that, we lived on the East Coast and we had parties with accordion players and my great grandparents speaking Italian and stuff like that. When we moved to California, that began a journey of me never again living in an Italian, even an Italian adjacent place. So when I started writing my novel, that's when I got really into my culture again. That was 2020. Through the Instagram journey, which has really been for the past 15 months. Everybody's gone along with me. I'm learning Italian. Like, I'm spending a lot of time in Sicily. That wasn't the case before. I was almost kind of had made myself a generic American person for a long time.
Yeah. Boo to that. We're not generic. No. Let's tell your story of how you got to where you are now, have written this book, are doing so many incredible things, re-engaging with your culture, encouraging other people to do it. I want to trace the lines of your creative journey. I heard you in one of the interviews you did on your Instagram page talking about how you wrote this first short story when you were a little girl. Can you tell me about how that or whatever other event it might be that was kind of like the inciting incident of your creativity built your confidence as a creative and urged you to keep listening to that writer voice?
So as a prefatory statement, I wouldn't just say I engage in magical thinking. I would say that I live in a magical world. Like, I'm living in the magical thinking. It's not like an intermittent trip. So if my external circumstances are too disparate from my magical thinking, then I tend to get in front of a pen and paper or a computer and write about where I should be. So some of my first short stories before that one that got me attention at school were just like fantasias of me and a big group of friends going on a trip together, like Babysitter's Club style, which never happened in my real life, or surprise parties that I wish people had thrown me. That would be a story. This story that I wrote that won me that award had to do with sort of a, is it a dream or is it not? You know, Castle on a Cloud, these two girls go off together. They have this adventure and then they wake up in their beds. They think it was a dream. And then the shoe one of them lost during the adventure was gone. And is it or isn't it real? And I was like, I didn't even realize I was being derivative. You read things and then like they excite you. And sort of like George Harrison accidentally stole that other band's background when he wrote My Sweet Lord. He stole He's So Fine. There was a legal case about that. It's very interesting. That was my derivative short story.
And what did it feel like? Like, what was that spark like inside of you that made you know, even as a little person, like, there's something here. This feels like me.
I took that Gallup poll as that sort of like strengths assessment. And my number one strength assessment is maximizer. I believe that we should focus on what we're excellent at or good at and make it amazing instead of mitigating things that we're not good at. So for me as a child, I knew God didn't put me on earth to do math, science, map skills. I knew that God put me on earth to speak and write. I knew that really young. I just didn't believe I could make money from it and have it be the focus. I thought it had to be ancillary. I thought it had to be a tool to use in service of a different career.
Okay, so let's talk about that because you ended up choosing law. So tell me how that choice came to be and that trajectory as an attorney.
I was an English major, French and history minor with a focus on World War II. So I was completely comfortable not studying things that were practical. I wasn't pre-law. I think I took one poli-sci class. After 9/11, I was working in an Italian restaurant. I was thinking of going to school to get a MFA in creative writing or to study as a screenwriter. Then 9/11 happened, and I was, like so many people, I was definitely diagnosably anxious. Then there was that anthrax thing. There was anthrax in the envelopes.
Oh, that was awful.
And it was just like, everything is falling apart. I need to do something extremely stable and reliable. It's like becoming an accountant or a doctor. Like, here's the list of things you have to do. If you do them, you will get X. I'm a very visceral decision maker. It was, I'm going to go to law school. I called my father and I said, Dad, I want to go to law school. Will you pay for my LSAT prep class? And he like gave me his credit card number immediately. He was like so excited.
Thank God.
That's a like immigrant desire for your kids to be professionals.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Wait, can we just take a pause and talk about that for a minute? Because
totally.
To this day, that's something that holds me back so much is that fear. I think I still have the fear that I'm going to die that my grandpa had in his heart when he moved over here on the boat and had to find a way to make money and couldn't for a while. How do you deal with that anxiety that sometimes tells your brain it's the truth, but it's not?
With regard to
career.
Going out creatively?
I mean, we're taking a kind of a sidestep right now, but you're doing something so creative now that is totally intuition guided and soul filled and following your true north. How did you get that voice in your head of, I have to be practical, I have to keep safe, I have to be practical, I have to keep safe, out of your head?
This sounds really dramatic, but
I love dramatic. I'm a theater major.
I was dying.
Yeah.
I was dying and eroding my sense of self when I worked as a lawyer. I guess you could say maybe I had to go through it because if I hadn't, I would have thought, oh, that would have been so much easier. There was so many arbitrary components of it. Like, you know, you have to be at work at 8 a.m. You have to wear stockings under your skirt. I mean, that wasn't everywhere, but there's absolutely creativity within law, but you have to pay so many years of horrible dues in order to get to the point where you're using that creativity. At first, I think on one case I worked on, I had 10 million pages of documents to review.
10 million?
For securities litigation. 10 million pages, which is just like, you know, take 8 months and review, because it's a case that's worth, you know, $1 billion. So I lived the sort of reverse penance of doing what I was not meant to do. I've always been a risk taker. I have one grandfather who was a risk taker as well. He only worked for himself. He was a big dreamer. He was, you know, a magical thinker. I just have realized that if I just have to do it this way, and if it ends up like I'm living in a cardboard box doing this, or if I'm like on a cliffside mansion, great, because this is the only thing I can do.
So speaking of which, you said I had to lose a lot before I had something to say. So let's talk about the latest inciting incident of your recent creativity. What happened in your marriage and how did it bring you to your creative power?
Well, I was married to a man who, for tax reasons, did not want to become American. Mm-hmm. And navigating that type of international marriage was fine. You know, he had a lot of resources and that was just fine before COVID came along. And there was a huge power disparity in that relationship because in addition to being very independent, I'm also very loving and nurturing. And I believe that that's an important role. My mother was a stay-at-home mother. When you're a stay-at-home mother, guess what you're doing economically? You're creating workers. That has economic value. And I think it's valuable to support your husband, obviously support your child above all. But I had to be subjugated to what was important to him. I was almost like a sidekick. And then that power disparity snowballed during COVID because his businesses were suffering. His stress started to escalate. And then the second he could get out of America, he left and he never came back. And that with the backdrop of a lot of other family trauma that's probably directly multi-generational Southern Italian trauma. I'm sure it's like, you know, mental illness. And
oh, yeah.
We are like the mental illness people.
Well, yeah, there's so much shame around the mental illness too. I'm the first person in my family to talk about mental illness openly in my therapy journey and how I'm dealing with all that. But there's like, oh, it's just agita. It's like, yeah, maybe some of it's agita, but like some of it's like you have clinical anxiety and it's fine, but we should talk about it.
Yeah, there's something we can do. And we have the resources now. When people say pharmacology is a cop out, my response is that when our grandparents even were growing up, they lived in a house probably that had like 12 people in it.
Yep.
And that is not an environment in which you can feel lonely and depressed. You could feel irritated, but you're probably not like staring off in existential despair because first of all, you're doing all these physical chores and you have this family around you. We are asked now as humans to live in a state of relative isolation. We are asked to live away from our family, away from our support systems. Any support we have, we might have to pay for. So my response when people say, you don't need therapy, you don't need medication, you know, that's not natural, is we're not living natural lives right now. So we can either adapt to this or we could go off and do something else.
Mic drop. Hello. Yes. That's so true. I never, ever thought of it that way. But we aren't living natural lives. Like the way our world is constructed right now in so many different facets is antithetical to how we were designed to live, especially in our culture.
Absolutely. So there's no Sunday dinner in my family now. My family is comprised of my father lives near me in Florida. My mother and my brother live in California. My extended family lives up north. Three of my grandparents just died in 2021, my last three. Yeah. I mean, well, God bless them. They lived to their 90s.
It's amazing.
Which almost makes it harder to live to 43 and have relied on them all that time.
Yeah.
But I don't have like the family dinner and the things and people don't pop by at all.
Yeah.
I don't read my grandparents used to read the obituaries up in Syracuse, New York, and they knew everybody. Like, I don't know anybody in the obituaries. But I want to because I have that like Sicilian embrace of death.
That's beautiful. So in my family, well, I should say specifically with my mom, there's a real fear around death. And one thing I've learned from your page is that Sicilian culture is mystical and wasn't afraid of darkness and embraced it. And so that's interesting that, like, I don't know how that happened in my bloodline, but there's like a fear around death and darkness, and like, we don't want to talk about it.
I think it's disconnection, because my grandparents, even, they were the first generation. They were very Americanized. When you go to Sicily, you kind of figure out, when I lived in California, I was very drawn to Mexican culture and Mexican celebration of death. You can read about this. Mexican and Sicilian culture, and particularly view towards death, they call Day of the Dead, Un Giorno di Morti in Sicilian. They celebrate it almost exactly like Mexicans celebrate Dia de los Muertos. Tons of color. It's like a party on the graves. And, you know, just like pictures of the ancestors and candles and things, because one of the reasons we fear death now is because when you die, American society asks you to move on. Don't dwell. In Sicily, you dwell. You're not afraid of death because when you die, you will live on and be discussed and revered. Whereas here, it's like, well, time to stop talking about your grandfather, Lee, because he was old and he died. It's like, no, I'm not going to stop.
That's how you continue your love and your relationship. Like, I recently heard somebody say, when someone dies in your life who you love deeply, you have to continue your relationship with them somehow and work on that relationship. Just because they're gone from this earthly plane doesn't mean they're gone from the entire universe. Energy cannot be created nor destroyed, right? So they're still here in some way. And I think that's beautiful. But going back to your journey, so your husband left and you had to figure it out. How did you get that creative call to write again? What did that feel like? What did that sound like? How did you listen?
I'm going to have to give Elizabeth Gilbert some mad ups here, because I read Big Magic, which I'm sure you've read.
Yes, she's the best.
You know, after I read Big Magic, I got like all my tattoos because she said, you know, decorate your body. And I didn't do it because she said it. I just felt permitted, you know, to be an educated, intelligent woman and to get tattoos. That's the hang up. But as far as the writing, I had this idea for a book called The Godmother. And I had been playing around with this idea in my mind for a couple years, but I did not believe that I was capable of writing a book. I thought, I'm going to write this book someday, but it was like one of those things you say where you hope that's enough and you don't actually have to write it. And then I can't even say what happened. It was right after I read the part of the book about how an idea, if you don't grab it and execute it, it will go out into the ether and be seized by someone else. And I was like, you know what? No, I'm going to write this book. But it was literally just like how I chose to go to law school. It was a random day in June. I sat down and I started writing, and I wrote for 9 hours a day for 60 days and wrote my first draft in 60 days.
Wow. Okay. So you know what it's like to be in creative flow, clearly. What does that feel like to you?
I felt a lot of determination, and I created this world that I just basically lived in for those, not just 2 months, but, you know, obviously you spend a lot of time with this book through all the revisions and things. I had this world around me that was starting to form, like almost like one of those Sim cities, like it was starting to build, and I had all these ideas that needed to happen. And what I would do is I would write without censoring myself, which means that you end, I wrote 144,000 words, and the novel now is 83,000. So, you know, you write a lot. If you write the way I write, you're going to throw a lot of it away because you're figuring it out as you write. But I just was having fun with it, and I was in this world. And at the end of every day, Toni Morrison said, you stop at a certain point before you're really done. And at the end of the day, I would say to myself, which the end of the day was like 2 p.m. because I was waking up at 4 in the morning, I asked my subconscious to deliver me the next day's writing. I know that sounds so like enlightened, but I'd never done anything like that before. It just also kind of like came into my mind. It could have been in Big Magic for all I know. I just asked for the answers to come to me, and they would come to me in the shower, while doing yoga, while cooking a Sicilian meal, which is something I did during the book. So I felt like I was in that world. I felt like something exciting could happen.
Uh-huh. And it did.
It did. It did. Absolutely.
Tell me, what was the thing you called the magic of your mind? Was it magical mind? What was it?
Magical thinking.
How was magical thinking involved in writing this book?
Magical thinking was involved in a few senses. One was the thought that if I wrote this book, that I could heal a relationship that is very beleaguered to this day. And that drove me a lot. And that relationship appears in the book. But magical thinking also functioned because, remember, we couldn't go anywhere in 2020. And I had this passion for learning about my culture and for reclaiming it. So in writing the book, it was magical world. I only listened to Sicilian music. I was on the phone with my Sicilian grandmother who was then alive. I was cooking Sicilian food. I was watching documentaries about Sicily. You know when people go through a city and they're wearing a GoPro and they're just walking down the street and you're like, what the hell are you going to do with that later? I watched those. I felt like saved by this book and this world. And I also wanted to be the main character.
The main character of the book. Okay. How has writing this book helped you become the main character of your life?
Well, a lot of my life to this point has been spent not doing well at the thing I'm not meant to do and apologizing to everyone for not doing it well and making that mean that I don't have a good work ethic and all kinds of cascades of self-flagellation. And when I wrote the book and began this journey, which required me to work harder than I've ever worked, it taught me that I have the work ethic of my ancestors. It taught me that I have more control over things than I think. I have control over what I bring. I have control over the process. I don't have control over the result, but I have control of holding myself forth as a writer. I have control of holding myself forward as a strategist. I have control of holding myself forward as a voice in the Italian American community. I don't need someone to deputize me or knight me. I have that ability. And if you don't agree with how I define myself, that's absolutely your right. But that's what came of this process for me.
How powerful, because so many of us are in that state where we're doing things that we're not meant to do. And like you said, beating ourselves up over it because we're not succeeding in the way we think we should. When really, if we just followed the calling of our heart, we could be excellent. And it wouldn't even matter if anybody approved of us because we would approve of our own selves. For somebody who is still feeling controlled by what they quote unquote should do, what would be your advice to them on how to start listening to their own soul and their own calling?
Well, people are in all different positions in life. Specifically, let's talk financially, because that's probably why you're not doing what your heart's telling you to do. It's probably because you feel like you can't do it financially. So I think the best thing that you can do is take steps while you're doing that thing that you don't want to do. Take steps towards what you do want to do. So I listened to your episode with Julia Cameron. You know, if you write every day, you can amass the pages that will comprise a book. For me, the mentorship and the learning and everything, we're in 2023. This began 3 years ago for me. So like, it's a process, but why not start now while you're at this thing that you don't like?
Yeah.
Another thing I will say is that if an opportunity comes along, even if it's scary and not as certain as what you're doing, don't miss the opportunity and put out what it is you're wanting. People are always asking in America, what do? You know, well, I work at an accounting firm, but I'm building a business helping people create a home garden. You know, like, don't not talk about it. Talk about it.
That's beautiful advice. And one thing I love that you talked about, and you kind of alluded to it with the editing process you did, was that you don't write outlines. So many people are like, you have to write an outline. I mean, they're very prescriptive in the way that they think writing, again, should go. What for you was the benefit of not writing an outline and just letting yourself go?
You have to write as you. There's not one way to write. Think about all the beautiful differences in our minds. I know people in my life who absolutely would insist on having an outline, or they just wouldn't be able to move forward. And those people could go on to win Pulitzer Prizes and generate amazing novels. For me, I had to let the characters show me what they needed to do. And I had to let the characters surprise me. It's okay afterwards to go in and be more formulaic. I think of the post first draft work as yeoman's work. When you create the first draft, you're like creating the clay from which Michelangelo sculpted the David. And then you go in and you do the yeoman's work. You have more yeoman's work if you do it my way. Some very careful writers, they have outlines. They take the time to not just write, but their writing is wrought. You know, they take this time. I don't. I let it flow out. And then that puts more on me afterwards. But that's what I feel comfortable with.
Well, the one that's very wrought and regimented isn't very Sicilian. I know that in your little video you did about it. You're like, not to say Sicilians can't be organized or regimented or whatever. But it's actually, I don't know if we're being true to ourselves, if we can be.
No. Sicily cannot be tamed.
Yeah.
Sicily is like the Amazon. Build a road, it's going to grow over. If we're going to have a road there, it's because we Sicilians allowed that road.
Right. Yeah. And many have tried to tame us. I mean, pretty much everyone has come through there. Just hasn't worked.
We had better bedfellows than others. But yes, it was really one of those things when different ruling powers got into Sicily where they were just like, kind of let it still be Sicily. We're over here taking money from it, but we're just going to let you all do what you do.
Your thing.
Right? It's very us.
What part of writing is connected to spirituality for you? Like, how is your creativity connected to your spirituality?
My creativity brought me closer to my spirituality. My creativity, it's continuing to show up for me and it's continuing to imbue me with these ideas, made me feel held and protected. I feel that I was a channel for the book. I think a lot of creative people feel that way because I actually don't understand how I wrote it. When I think about it now, it's not you. You take your experiences, of course, you know, the work you've done on yourself and your God-given talents and everything, but something flows through you. It's a deeper process than I think we'll ever understand. And that's divine.
Did you pray at all in the writing of this? Like, I know you said you asked your subconscious to give you the answers, but did any part of you say, God, please come through me, like teach me the message that you want me to share? What were your prayers like connected to this writing?
I prayed ardently to the Virgin Mary. I needed her so much. I needed that mother that's always there. I learned how to pray to her in Sicilian. She was with me every day.
Can you share that? I don't know if it's too personal.
How to pray it in Sicilian?
Yeah.
There's all different dialects in different parts of Sicily, but it's Ave Maria, piena di grazia, o Signore è con voi. Voi benedetta siete in ci femmine. E benedito estu frutti de vos utro, Jesu. Santa Maria, Madre di Deo, preati per noi peccatori, ac amor ante l'ora de nostra morti. Amen.
Ah, bellissima.
We have a beautiful language, don't we?
We do. Lee, this is so difficult because I want to sob the entire time I'm talking to you.
I'm like that too.
Yeah, it's so beautiful. So you prayed to Mother Mary and just really developed a relationship with her.
I would throw in an Our Father too, and I absolutely love Christ. I had a change in my relationship to Christ after my grandfather died because he was a Christ guy and my grandmother was a Mary girl. I was blessed to be present at my grandparents' deaths, both of them, and then almost the third one. And that changed my relationship to Christ. But with Mary and learning from our sistren in the Italian-American community, how deep the goddess worship is in Southern Italy, which is like, you know, a lot of people are kind of jumping on this and say, what do you mean goddess? You know, there's only one, this and that. It's about the form in which people want to experience God. I believe there are all these holy people who've existed throughout time and they're all portals. And the Virgin Mary, I've tried experimenting with different religions, but the Virgin Mary just really, she is the ultimate self-sacrificing mother.
Yeah.
And just turning to her, she knows pathos, you know, she wants the best for you. Your mother always does. A healthy mother.
Yes, that's true. I mean, I would always say that because obviously I have my issues with the Catholic Church. I guess I shouldn't say obviously. I do have my issues with the Catholic Church being a strong woman. I love the post you did recently about why aren't there female priests? It's always bothered me that our cap is being a nun, and I don't think that's right, and I don't think that's fair, and I actually just don't think it's good for anyone. But I did always love that in Catholicism, we saw Mother Mary at the front of the church. And I can't say that in other forms of Christianity. I mean, I too have dabbled in different religions. I've gone to like the rock churches, and I've noticed that those churches that, yeah, they got the coffee and they have the donuts, which by the way, as a Catholic, I'm like, what are you doing? I'm not here to dine. I'm not here to see a rock show. I'm here to worship. But I don't see any women at the helm besides to make maybe a little announcement. So I think that has always been a powerful part of Catholicism. And it feels like that's where the Italian, Sicilian, strong woman thing comes in. Like, I've always tried to make sense of how can there be this strong woman at the helm? But then our voices are completely silenced.
I decided that I was not going to let people's dogmatic edicts, I was not going to let a male bureaucracy keep me from my ancestral faith. So I've chosen folk Catholicism, which is something Mary Beth Bonfilio and Dolores Alfieri Taranto talk about. I've chosen folk Catholicism, which I interpret as I get to love Christ and Mary and the saints in the way that I want to. I get to do what I want. You do not tell me this, this, and this. And Sicilians, frankly, live that way. They're not big on the form of Catholicism we have in the United States is very Protestant. There's a lot of talk about sin. There's a lot of emphasis on male figures. Saints are very de-emphasized compared to Italy. I mean, every other day they're carrying a statue down the street, crying and throwing rose petals. So I get to be Catholic that way. I get to be of it and disagree with it the same way I'm an American and I can disagree with America. Because before I thought, I have to leave because blah, blah, blah. Well, what if I stayed and spoke up?
Yeah, I think that's extremely powerful. I guess I'm a folk Catholic too, because that's exactly how I feel. Actually, one of my like lovely people who's like followed my journey for years on my Instagram reached out to me because she saw the thing I posted of me in Sicily. And she's like, Lauren, are you Catholic or are you spiritual? Which one? I'm like, well, I'm both. Like, I love God. I love Jesus. I love Mother Mary. I love the saints. I do love the prayers and the rituals. And like, I love the candles. I love the songs. But I disagree with, you know, the bigotry of the church, the discrimination within the church, the pedophilia, obviously, within the church. Like, those things, obviously, I'm not on board with. But I'm not going to allow the parts of my faith that work for me, that make me feel whole, to be ripped away from me. I still get to keep those parts. And I can believe in my other little fun things, too, like astrology and whatever.
Yes.
So I love that. I love
that. Yeah, I believe in all my things. And that's triggering for some people right now. I think it's mostly not triggering for people because I think we're all, you and I and our group around us are not the only ones kind of becoming interested in positive occult things, herbal magic and rituals and all these things that our ancestors would have readily done and just thought of as just part of everything you do. You hang the garlic up and you put the corno on and you just do that, you know? I just think when people get into legalism within religion, that to me is a huge impediment to experiencing the divine.
Mm. Can you go deeper into that?
It doesn't go. Christ's words, if you just look at the red highlighted words in the Bible, there's just not a lot of nonsense in there. There's that famous scene in the temple courtyard where all the apostles and disciples are saying, hey, teacher, you know, you say you're the way and the truth and the life. Look at that Gentile over there, meaning non-Jew. Is he going to be going to heaven? He doesn't believe in the God, the one God. Christ had an absolute opportunity to say he's not going to heaven because I'm the way. He said, don't worry about him. God might have his own plan for him. Worry about yourself, hypocrite. I mean, how much more clear can you get? He's just saying, just mind your business. Love God, love your neighbor. Mind your business. And that's the same message, love God and love your neighbor, that you'll find at the core of all religions that aren't, you know, cults, which is an interesting distinction. You know, I don't think love God and love your neighbor is like fundamental precept of Scientology. But like for most of the world's religions, really, Islam, Buddhism, my theology is religions are languages. It's just there's no right one.
Yeah.
This is just our language. This is the language we speak.
So you're getting out there and saying some things that some people think are controversial. And you're just speaking your truths. You're sharing a story, whatever it is. But you're getting some backlash in the comment sections. And you've been open about it and talked about it and joked about it. But how are you dealing with that? Do you brace yourself before you put something out? Or are you just like, you know what? I stand by this 100%. Here it is. What's your feeling when you're putting out something that maybe some people think is controversial?
I'm really cool with it now. When I was first posting things, I was so surprised, especially because the first things I posted back in February, March last year were really non-controversial. And I discovered that there is a deep wound between Italian Americans and Italians. I think a lot of Italian Americans don't realize this wound exists because you really discover it when you start to engage with Italians, modern day Italians all throughout the country. And I now understand that they have a very different perspective on belonging, on what does it mean to be an Italian? What does that entail? What does that require? Their belief is very different from ours. And I'm in acceptance about that now. So I'm not shocked and hurt when people say, why don't you pronounce your last name properly? Or, you know, what your parents named you, an American first name, you're not Italian. And now I'm just like, I just know that that's going to come up for them. That's their thing and I can't control it. And then there's also the religious thing. How can you be talking about tarot and citations to all these Bible things about witchcraft and stuff? And to me, a lot of that stuff comes out of fear.
Yeah.
Even like the Italians with the Italian Americans, I think there's like a fear of being drowned out. Remember that the diaspora of Italy far surpasses that of the population of Italy. And I think that the people in Italy want to make sure that they retain their national identity, which is different from ours. And then with the occult stuff, I think people are just afraid of, you know, they're afraid of damnation. They're afraid of being separated from paradise. And if you look at it that way, you can have a lot of empathy for it. They just want to go to the right place. And maybe they're scared you won't go to the right place.
Right.
I think that's where it's coming from.
Well, it sounds like you have your head on straight about what you might expect when people are reaching out. And also you're seeing where it's coming from so it doesn't wound. You know, it's not a personal thing. So that's good advice for anyone who's putting something out there that is truthful to them, but that might ruffle other people's feathers. I'd love to talk about your grandfather, because I know as you were finalizing the book, you were holding his hand as he was passing away and you were working on your manuscript at the same time. Tell me this story and why that was so powerful.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Oh, my grandfather is probably the person that I had most admire in the world. He came from absolutely nothing, youngest of seven children. Starting at age 9, he was working 3 jobs, paperboy, bakery, and another one that I can never remember. He called me Shugs. He would always say, Shugs, things did not come easily for me. He went to night school. He got a college degree while working in a foundry and ended up being corporate vice president of that same company by the time he retired. He was an Italian-American hero in his community of Syracuse. He was always worried about me because he was a guy who played by the rules. He worked for one company from age 18 to 65. He just couldn't fathom, you know, oh my God, my granddaughter, she's living on the edge. You know, what's going to happen when I die? That, I think, kept both my grandparents alive longer. Is we need to stay alive for Leanne, is what they call me. We need to stay alive for our granddaughter. And so I wanted to get that book done. I knew by that point, you can tell when people are dying. I don't know, have you ever been with someone who's dying?
Yes.
Like an old person? Mm-hmm. Their breathing changes. They go into this sort of state and you can see it's like, it's beautiful. It felt like I would communicate with my great grandmother in my mind, who was the only great grandmother I never met. And I would say, you brought him into this world and I'm going to hold your little boy's hand while he goes out. And I wanted my grandfather to know that I'm okay. And I wanted my grandfather to see me have the kind of grit that he had. He worried and fought for our family every day of his life. He died a hero in my mind. This book is dedicated to him and my grandmother because I understand what God's love is because they showed me what it is every day of my life. So I held his hand and I kept working because that's what he would have done. There's no rest for Grandpa because it's fighting for his family.
Oh, God.
And I had to fight for me and my son. I'm a single mom. No one's going to do it. There's no more Grandpa to protect me. And I wanted to show him, I'm taking that part of you and I'm going to put it inside myself so that all that you learned isn't wasted.
Oh, my God, Lee. That is so beautiful.
I talk to him every day.
When you describe the image of you holding his hand while you're writing the book, I literally see this energy from him passing from him to you. Like, it's his courage coming through you, you keeping up this familial tradition of living courageously and living ferociously and living for your family and making sure your family lives on and is taken care of.
Yeah, my grandpa even gave me the gift of a very profound moment of what they call terminal lucidity, which is that he came out of that comatose state after we believed he had died. And he sat up and he looked me in the eye. And then I watched his spirit exit his body. It changed my life. People ask me, you know, questioning the Catholic Church, could you question your faith? Could you question God? And my answer is no. I'm questioning dogma. I'm questioning bureaucracy. I have no doubt anymore because my grandfather, his final gift to me was a gift that really faith does not require proof. We're called to have faith whether we see proof or not. But my grandfather showed me proof. That was his final gift to me of myriad gifts.
Yeah, it's like so profound. I don't really have any words for it, but you have your why. That's clear.
Absolutely. They're watching, just like you said earlier. They're still there. They're just in a different form.
I watched my grandfather die too, and I also got a gift from him, Lorenzo, Larry, the one I was telling you about. He was my mom's dad. I wasn't supposed to be home. I live in LA. My parents are in Detroit, and I wasn't supposed to be home, but I got this acting job, actually, weirdly enough, in Florida, but I needed the money at the time, and I got an opportunity to work the Detroit Auto Show. So I went back home to Detroit to work the auto show, and I never was the type of person to like pick the money over the art, but like, for whatever reason, I was like, you have to do it. Just go to Detroit, do the auto show. And my grandpa wasn't in bad condition when I made that choice. But when January rolled around, he started deteriorating. He had heart disease. And he wasn't really talking like much by the time I got home. But when I walked into the room, he said, Lauren. And so I got to hear him say my name one more time. And then he ended up going into cardiac arrest several times. They had to put him on a respirator. And anyway, that like preserved him long enough for everyone in my family to be there when he passed. So they pulled the respirator out and he couldn't talk because, you know, it had been down his throat. So that kind of takes away your ability to talk for a while. And he was going to pass quickly after they took it out. But they took it out. He looked up at all of us and said, Malt, I love you. I love you. I love you. And then he passed. And so it was the same way. Like, there's no reason he should have been able to do that. But I'm the same as you. I've never questioned my faith. I've never questioned whether God is real. It's just, I think there have been people who have tainted the faith and made it for their own purposes rather than God's purposes. That's so beautiful. We do have to carry on for our family.
They really gave us so much. We stand on their shoulders. Everybody in America comes from someone who had some pretty big balls.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just going to get on this boat and see what happens. Some people were brought against their will, but they have a lot of balls too. You know, they've had to build themselves up from having been subjugated. And for those of us who did, our ancestors did actively get on those boats and rafts and on foot to get here. We have a lot of determination. We are a nation that descends from a risk taker and we stand on their shoulders. They put us in this position. So we're the last of their line. There's no one rooting for us like them.
So you've called upon the bravery that is part of your bloodline and have started an incredible new publishing company. Can you tell me the story of how this came to be and what you aim to do with it?
Absolutely. So in my Instagram journey, I came across this girl that I just found delightful called the Sweet Paisana. It turns out she has a name in real life. It's Sarah. And she and I interacted. Actually, she was getting kind of heaped on by the Italian community for mispronouncing an Italian word on one of her reels. And
oh, brother.
I did a little story saying, you know, this is a message of solidarity. And that sent her to my profile and she saw I was a novelist. Quickly, we exchanged manuscripts. We became support systems for each other as we both were able to. At the time, I already had a literary agent. She subsequently got a literary agent for her novel. And for me in the submissions process, when I went out on the submissions process, the message that I kept getting was, really love the story, just not sure how to position it, just not sure it's topical, which is very strange to me because it's like a feminist departure from The Godfather, which is like a book that sold 50 million copies. And, you know, we just saw The Offer come out, the television show about the creation of the movie. So I didn't understand what they meant. And I listened to the Italian American podcast episode with Christopher Castellani, who's become a mentor. And he just said, there is not a view in the literary community of Italian Americans as erudite or as elevated storytellers. We're the storytellers of just the checkered tablecloth, mother with the apron, which of course you can have profound narratives around that. But that's really all that is expected of us. Or like actual mafia killing stuff, that's also permitted. And of course, that is part of our past. You know, the mafia thrived in Sicily. Yes, it did. But there wasn't space, it seemed, for either of our stories, which were Italian-American stories. And I think Adriana Trigiani has talked about this too. An Irish story is considered literary. You know, like there's, you can kind of go through the, a young boy growing up in Glasgow, a Scottish story. But the person in the Italian-American enclave or Italian-American community isn't. And we just realized that we've learned a lot about the importance of representation from folks in the BIPOC community. And you need to see an image of yourself. You need that little girl and boy to see an image of themselves that's elevated, that's the best of their culture, not just the lowest. And we thought that there should be a place where Italian-American storytellers could bring their stories so that we can start to support a new wave of representation.
And so what did you do?
So we withdrew our novels from our agents and from the submissions process. We were lucky to find an angel investor who wanted to begin supporting this venture, though we definitely need more support because the more support we have, the more authors we can sign. That got us started. We had capital behind us, which really made us feel proud and empowered. And we set about doing everything you do with a publishing company, starting off with our two novels as the initial offerings. So trial by fire. You had another episode with the, I forgot her name, but she was saying, my advice if you want to go start your own private practice is just start.
Oh yeah. I know who you're talking about now.
Yes.
Viviana Coles. Yeah.
We're learning this process as we go. This vision of we're theatrical people. We are theatrical people. We are a theatrical people. A lot of people in publishing talk about platform. But I think they don't know what to do with it. By that, I don't mean authors. I think that publishing companies want authors to have platforms, but I don't think they actually have an articulated sense of what authors can do. We're authors who do not believe we are above responding to every DM and comment. We're authors who want to hear what our readers care about or what our viewers want to see reels about. And we really are authors who love our audience. We're not like on a pedestal. We're in an engaged relationship. And we want to invite that type of author because as that type of author, with our support, you can create incredible success from the support that you gather around you.
So could you say the name of the company? Is it Selvatica?
Selvatica Books. Okay. Yes, Selvatica, which is a Latin and Italian term for wild, meaning untamed, indigenous. Like a lot of the flora and fauna around Mount Etna have the word Selvatica in it, as both Sicilian Americans. We also wanted a name that was a little more obscure. You know, we didn't want like a name that's immediately like, oh, that's an Italian word. We wanted it to be a little bit more something that sounded elevated, and which we really are an elevated people. And we have a lot of sophistication, particularly with our engagement with nature and the natural world.
So if somebody wants to work with Selvatica Books, how can they get in touch, both either for an investment or if they have a novel idea? And it's just novels right now. Are you open to memoirs? Are you open to children's books? Like, what are the parameters?
Yes, yes, and yes. Our primary interest, our mission, is to elevate and share Italian-American voices, particularly stories of strong female women defying cultural expectations. That's like our dream. Our secondary that we also love is voices and stories and works that celebrate the Italian diaspora, wherever that person could be. It could be an Australian Italian man, or theoretically could be someone who's not Italian, who's an Italophile and loves the culture. So in order to get in touch with us, we have our website, Salvatica Books. You can email Sarah or myself, Lee at Salvatica Books, Sarah at Salvatica Books. Quite easy to get us. And of course, we'd love to talk about capital, which is the steam that fuels this locomotive. And as far as our storytellers themselves who are listening, that's going to start. Our submissions acceptance is going to start in January 2024. So this is the time to be writing your story, revising your story, getting it ready, because we're going to be ready to blast off in January. Look at our community. We have 23 million Italian Americans. There have to be so many good books out there.
So many good books. And so many Italians who have yet to unleash their inner creative, maybe because of the fear. But what this conversation has made me realize is we are an inherently brave people. And that by being as brave as you possibly can be for the circumstances you're in, you're actually honoring your heritage, the people that came before you, that stayed alive so that you could pursue your dreams and be the fullness of who you are without any repression, remembering everything that came before you and recovering anything that was lost. Lee, you're such a beautiful example of this. Thank you for putting your story, yourself, your heart out into the world and for encouraging other people to do the same, to remember who they are and to encourage other people to remember who they are as well. I'm so blessed to know you and I hope that you'll come back and I hope we can be friends because I love you.
I feel the same way. And I could, everything you said, I could say the same to you. You're doing beautiful work. I've listened to so much of your podcast in the past few days and it's amazing. You're such a warm and empathic host and you do such a great job of both sharing your own story and bringing out other stories. So you must keep doing what you're doing. You're going to be like our Italian American Oprah. Like you should have a show.
Do you know that that's my dream? I used to say I want to be the Italian Oprah.
This is it. It's there for the taking. You're her.
Speaking of astrology, we do have the same sun and moon sign. So I'm just saying, maybe there's something really? In the water. Yeah, she's an Aquarius sun, Sagittarius moon. I know you're a Sagittarius.
I'm a Sagittarius sun.
Yeah. So good synergy between us too. The sun and the moon connection, we got something going. We have an understanding.
We're definitely be hanging out. I think you know that. So
please, I have a guest room. So anytime you come to LA, you got a place with me. I know you have family here too.
I'm in.
You know, you're welcome here if you need a little breather.
It does not take much for an Italian to accept an invitation. I like you. You like me. Let's do it.
Let's do it.
Let's have a meal.
We're family. We're basically cousins at this point. Now, one final thing. When is The Godmother coming out? Do we have a date on that yet?
The Godmother's pre-orders are open. So you can pre-order through Salvatica Books, through LeeEsposito.com. On Instagram, you can go through my link tree and you can find pre-order links. You can pre-order signed copies if you want. But actual order will be fulfilled and the actual pub date is May 16th of this year. And the same is true for Sarah's book.
Amazing.
The Owner and the Wife is the name of her book.
I'll have to have Sarah on too so we can give her books and props. I love that you're partnering together. It's just so powerful. I'm 4 chapters into the book. I'm obsessed. It is so good. I've gotten chills several times while reading it. I've laughed. I've cried. There was this line in it that really spoke to me. You said the Ibarra women had learned to cloak their powers in the commonplace. Just as a final thing, what does that mean? Because I'm curious if it's my interpretation.
Hiding in plain sight, engaging in all these mystical practices, having all these profound effects on people, creating art, that it seems like a meal. You know, it seems like gardening, whatever it is, but it's not. It's magic. It's the magic that we do as women that everyone doesn't recognize, but people are starting to.
I love that. That's what I thought. And I want to encourage you listening, if you have a power like the one that Lee is harnessing right now through her writing and through her sharing of her culture and herself and her strength as a woman, don't hide it in commonplace. Be bold, be out there. We have your back. We will support you. And the world needs your power. We don't need to dim our light. We need to shine it brighter so others feel safe to do the same. Thank you for doing that, Lee. Love and adore you. You're my paisana for life.
Love you too, paisana.
Thanks for listening and thanks to my guest, Lee Esposito. For more info on Lee, follow her at Miss MS Lee Esposito and visit her website, LeeEsposito.com.
Her book, The Godmother, is available for pre-order now on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or wherever you get your books. It officially releases on May 16 via Selvatica Books. And for more info on Selvatica Books, check out selvaticabooks.com. Thanks to Rachel Fulton for editing this episode. Follow her at Rachel M. Fulton. Thanks to Liz Full for the show's theme music. Follow her at Liz Full. And again, thank you. If you like what you heard today, remember to rate, review, and follow the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Share the show with a friend and post about it on social media. Tag me at Lauren LaGrasso and at Unleash Your Inner Creative, and I will repost to share my gratitude. Also tag the guests at Miss Lee Esposito so she can share as well. My wish for you this week is you realize how inherently brave you truly are, just given everything your ancestors went through for you to be here right now. Whatever struggle you're in, whatever goal you're trying to achieve, you can do it. I love you and I believe in you. Talk with you next week.